This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Scorsese's new movie, The Age of Innocence, opened today. It's very out of character for the king of contemporary New York Italian realism to adapt an Edith Wharton novel set in 19th century New York high society. We're about to get some insights into Scorsese's character and his movies as we listen to a Q&A session with him recorded earlier in the summer at New York University, presented by their Department of Cinema Studies at the Tisch School of the Arts. The questions were asked by the department chair, William Simon. Some of those questions were submitted in writing by the audience. Scorsese's movies include Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, New York, New York, Raging Bull, The Last Temptation of Christ, King of Comedy, Goodfellas, and Cape Fear. Here's Scorsese responding to a question about how his movies have reworked film genres.
Taxi Driver was something we were talking about, film noir, the film noir made after the war, the darkness that came in to the soul of this country after World War II, and how it revealed itself in these films, films which were influenced by Germans and French, I think, German filmmakers, you know. And what we did with the Taxi, I said it should be New York Gothic. I said, you know, it's like a Gothic horror film, only it's New York, and it's a cabbie. That could be rough, you know, and understandably too, because De Niro drove a cab for a couple of nights, took a couple of weeks, and I sat in the cab with him a couple of times. It's really it's a hell of a job. I mean, God, it's awful. In terms of getting in and then a person telling you where to go, you don't know where you're going. The person behind you controls your existence for the next hour, next half hour. Anything could happen. And it's really Paul Schrader's thing, Paul Schrader's script, and his vision. But the style of it was certainly influenced by a sort of pushing forward of the film noir is what we were trying for. And then, of course, I went further with it in New York, New York, which was, again, after the war, there were American musical comedies that were made before the war in the 30s, and then, of course, in 1944, you had Vincent Minnelli do Meet Me in St. Louis, where it changed the form of the musical film, where instead of the Rodgers and Astaire pictures, where you would have the wonderful Gershwin songs, and they'd sing, and there was boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. In Meet Me in St. Louis, the songs came out of the characters and they progressed the plot and the emotions of the people. And it became part of it became a very new way of doing musicals. And after the war, however, you still had these beautiful, splashy Technicolor pictures, but some of them were kind of strange, like one called My Dream Is Yours with Doris Day and Jack Carson and Lee Bowman. And she loves Lee Bowman, but he's a cad. He wears a terrific a white dinner jacket with a black belt. He looks great. And Jack Carson wears the same jacket, but he's always heavy. I mean, I always liked Jack Carson because he was so likable as a character actor. He loves her, but she doesn't care for him at all. She likes Lee Bowman, who's a cad. And basically, it's these undercurrents of people in show business, of people trying to entertain, of people trying to express themselves artistically. And you have these strange undercurrents of something not being right with their personal lives. What are they trying to tell us? But they try everything. They try everything. They even have a stupid dream sequence where Jack Carson and Doris Day are dressed up as the Easter Bunny. I said, what were they? What were they thinking? They were trying to still make it a musical. Come and enjoy yourselves. In the meantime, they're punching you under the table, like, you know, it's like, that's not good, boy, you know. This is going to be a problem for her when she marries this guy, you know. I said, what is this all about? And that's only one of them. Actually, it's a pretty good film. It's directed by Michael Curtiz in beautiful Technicolor. And then there was, I think you really hit the stride when you do, when you have Judy Garland, James Mason's version of George Cukor's version of Star is Born, 1954, 55. That's the real level I was trying to reach and try to revise that for the 70s in New York, New York. And what I tried to do there was to have, and this is where it comes in very clearly, the improvisatory style in the foreground and the old studio style in the background. The background, however, consisted of sets that had to be built. When you build a set, cost money. And I didn't realize when I went out to LA to do the picture, I was living in LA for a few years, and I had the thought, it's a funny thing, of course, because I guess you're young, you think nothing fades and nothing goes away. And so I still thought that a lot of these sets existed and these negatives were fine and things like that. So I got there and I said, well, isn't that the old MGM set for the train and the beginning of the bandwagon and all that? It's falling apart. I said, yeah, that's the only thing that exists now. And there were only a few other places. And so we had to build these sets. And that costs money. So the problem was then waiting for us to get the inspiration for improvisation and adding to scenes when we had all that money being thrown into the actual production. And when in the opening of the picture, when there's an improvisation where he's trying to pick a date, have a date with Liza Minnelli in the film, we worked on that scene for 1 week with 1,000 extras each day. And that's when it started to get, that's when it started to go wrong. Because the money started to pile up. And I kept saying, yeah, but we're getting something good. And we were getting some interesting things. However, what I'm trying to say is that you have you had a situation where one style, the improvisatory style, is very often better controlled in a lower budget. Every time a set was built, that was the only scene that we had to shoot. In other words, you could not go somewhere else and shoot because it wasn't built. So we were improvising in this one scene, and the set was ready for us to move into the next week, but we improvised ourselves into a situation where we couldn't go to that set. And so it became a great difficult learning lesson for us, because it was a matter of controlling improvisation, controlling the improvisation to the point of literally, and you get down to basics, you sit in a room, you say, okay, now what's the picture about? And what are the scenes about? And I knew what it was about. There was a combination of these, the pushing it forward into the 70s and bringing the undercurrents that were in those films of the musicals with the strange undercurrents of personal problems and bringing that in the foreground to make it grow with what was happening in the country. But the way I went about it was not the most scientific way. And then after that, we were able to do with Raging Bull to come back and do it properly, I think, you know, in terms of improvisation.
And then we have a question here about storyboarding. And I mean, I think it's fairly well known that at a certain point that you used to storyboard entire pictures in great detail. And I guess that the question here is do you still continue to do that, and does storyboarding play a part in writing the script and so on? And I guess, I mean, if I could add one other aspect to that, since you've been talking a lot about improvisation, is that there seems to me to be a tension between, on the one hand, a great deal of pre-production planning through storyboarding, but then a major sort of use of improvisation.
Well, what happens,
how do those relate to
Well, what
each
happens,
other?
For example, I mean, I had to storyboard. I guess it goes right back to the years when I was younger, when I was just doing these little drawings in a room by myself, and I guess I have to go back to that. There's no doubt I storyboarded everything, and a lot of it has to do with storyboarding for economic reasons, because you didn't have the money to shoot. You didn't have the money to get there and not know what you were going to do. You had to have a plan. I had to have a plan. Now, there are a lot of other people who don't do that, and, I mean, Fellini doesn't do it, and I understand Lynch does not do it either. I mean, goes and they work. Bertolucci doesn't do it. Gets there, and they work it out. Benjamin Storaro, they work it out. Some of the most beautiful stuff ever filmed. It depends on the temperament. I just think that for me, everything that I imagine in my head as images that move and intercut together and to create a certain feeling, that's the way to shoot that scene. Now, the dialogue scenes sometimes do not take that same, it doesn't fall into the same law. So that, for example, you can have a scene in Goodfellas. Now, Goodfellas, the script of Goodfellas written by myself and Nick Pileggi, pretty much in the script, everything was almost like being in a storyboard. I have since after Raging Bull and King of Comedy, I've stopped doing all the pictures. I just do small pictures on the side of the script now. After Hours, I started doing that. There's lots of pictures on the sides of the script, and my director of photography, Michael Baldhaus, would transfer the pictures and Xeroxes, and then write them out and figure out what to do with them. And in terms of like how to shoot this particular one, what piece of equipment to use, etc. And in Goodfellas, the script was written that way, so that I didn't have to do the drawings. It's almost like documentary, where at one point he robs Air France, I think it is, for some money, and he brings the money to Paulie, and Paulie says, "Hey, don't spend that money all in one place. You cut close-up money going down to a table, money being picked up, check, all of that." In other words, we didn't sit in the editing room and say, "Oh, gee, we need a close-up of the money," you know? No. He just told him, "Don't spend all in one place. He's spending it." You know, it's like throwing the money. That's the idea. And so the whole script was like that. But when you get a scene that was improvised with Joe Pesci saying, "What are you laughing? What do you think I'm funny? Why do you think I'm funny?" Now, you can't draw. I mean, that's not drawn. But I must tell you, what that is, is two cameras. I'm Joe, he's Ray. There's two cameras here. One this way, one this way, shooting me. And it's not a close-up. We didn't do the scene 10 times going medium, wide first, and wide, then tighter. It stayed in two frames, and the two frames are important because you have Joe, and you have guys around him, and you have Ray and you have guys around him, and you have to see the reaction of what it does to the people in the room. You got to feel how those guys start to, you know, he's only, don't ask, he can talk for himself. You have to see that. You have to see that the mood change on everybody. Because if you go into close-ups, you may be getting like an intense thing. It becomes not truthful, I felt. And so that kind of thing, you know, you draw a picture, you say, oh, it's got to have so-and-so. We're going to have to, you know, just set up the two cameras this way so we can get them two medium shots, which goes right back to like the kind of American framing I used to love in Howard Hawks pictures. He's got like 10 people in the frame all the time. If you ever look at Red River and The Thing, look at the movie The Thing that he produced. I mean, or Only Angels Have Wings. I mean, it's amazing. But of course, at that time, there was no small screen video, so that image was projected, and you would see their faces, even though it was from the below the knees up. You'd see the expression of their face. So on TV, it's a little hard now. But that kind of thinking has to go into a scene like that. Otherwise, you'd be there, and you do it in the cutting. And when you do some things in the cutting, sometimes, unfortunately, it becomes selecting, not directing. And that's a problem. Everybody falls into it. Sometimes you shoot something a certain way, and you think it's going to work this way, and then suddenly you find yourself going into the outs. And, she turns here. Quick, put it over here. Oh, great. Okay, that matches. Now, I mean, that happens, you know. But it's something Andre Dutat said to me. He says, a lot of people these days are becoming selectors. They put 10 cameras down, and then they go in the editing room, and it becomes, the image. That one looks good, put it this way. There's one guy who does that, though, but he's certainly a director. It's Kurosawa. They asked him, how does he shoot his battle scenes? He says, one take. I said, really? He said, 9 cameras. Sets it up all day. And these guys, and I know this, I found out the secret. When we were out there in Japan, he told me, he said he has 20 horsemen. He says, he calls them his 20 horsemen. These are guys who've been with him like for 25 years. They do all the stunts in the foreground. They take care of him. They set up, they work out the shot with his nephew, Mike, in a way, who is one of the producers, and his Saito, the cameraman. They work it out, they know it, and then they call him to come from the house. It's okay. Now he can come down. And then he lays it all together, but it's a matter of getting the light in the right position. That's so he doesn't have to wait there. He's 83 years old, he's still directing.
We're listening to a talk by film director Martin Scorsese, recorded in June at New York University. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back to a talk with Martin Scorsese, recorded at New York University.
In order to make the personal films that you sometimes also need to make the commercial films,
yeah.
Is that still
yeah.
the case, or
yeah.
in the current industry, is that still a situation?
In the 70s, we tried, as I said, with Taxi Driver and Alice's Liver Anymore to make, or even Mean Streets to a certain extent. I was so glad when Warner Brothers bought it because it was the place that made the greatest gangster films. And Mean Streets has that kind of lineage, in a way. But it was not really a gangster. It was something, it was more of a personal statement. But I was interested in the 70s of making films that that came out of the genre, commercial genres, and we were trying to revise them. I remember Francis Coppola yelling at me and George Lucas about, you can't revise that stuff. He said, Boxcar Bertha, you can't, don't try to change the endings the way they, he said, no, the good guy has to win this. People expect a certain kind of thing in a mythic film where you have mythic characters, they expect certain things. And you have to give it to them, you have to deliver. And George was trying to do something, it was before American Graffiti. And he said, it doesn't work when you do that sort of thing. And in some cases, he was quite right. But by the time I did Raging Bull, I didn't care what it was. I didn't care. I really thought that it was the end of my career, basically. I was going to go to Italy and make films, 16-millimeter films about saints. I thought. They all laugh at me, but that's what I was going to do. I was talking, we were doing research, and because it was really Rye Television at the time, was doing some really good films, and Bertolucci was working on television. Ermanno Olmi and Francesco Rossi, all these guys, and I was sort of inspired by the Rossellini films, and I said, well, let's just do that, and I didn't understand, you know, what was happening. I really never had a good business sense about that sort of thing, but when I did Raging Bull, I just threw it all in there and figured it would leave. I did eventually wind up moving out of California and stayed in New York in the past decade, but after that, things changed radically, and in the case, for example, of getting Last Temptation of Christ made, I had to promise I'd do a mainstream film for them and for Universal. And it became Cape Fear. And it was as close as to a mainstream picture I could get, I thought. But the thing was, again, there are major challenges to try to deal with the thriller elements and also a remake. You know, it's a remake. You got to be very, very careful when you deal with that kind of thing. After Hours was a picture I tried to get myself sort of back into fighting shape in a way, which was to do a film at the age of 40 that I did at the age of 30. And that is, you know, shoot 40 days, 40 nights, running around, do it for $4.5 million all in, including his salary, which was hardly anything, and try to, at that time, because the 80s, America in the 80s, making certain kinds of films, there was the films that were like, you know, the Spielberg Lucas things, which were so, making so much money. It was the mega hits. And here I had made a picture called King of Comedy, which closed in 4 weeks, you know. So after that, I tried to do Last Temptation of Christ, and the plug was pulled about 4 weeks before we started shooting. And then I realized we couldn't get anything made that I wanted to get made. And so I came across this idea called, which became After Hours, and worked on that and did kind of a low-budget film again and tried to stay alive creatively. And then that led to fairly well, and that led to a more commercial project, again, where I was trying the same kind of thing within a more mainstream framework, and that was The Color of Money, in which we're able to do a picture with those movie stars coming in $1 million under budget. And then after that, it was a matter of literally being able to make Last Temptation of Christ, but again for a price, $7 million, all in. That's salaries for everybody and everything else. And shooting in North Africa for $7 million is not bad, but it was certainly, I'll never forget the surrounding of the temple. I had five guys from Rome, five stuntmen, and they had Roman costumes on, Roman soldier costumes, right? And I had to, there was a trouble in the temple, whatever, and they look up, they hear a sound, they look up, and Roman soldiers come up, and then Roman soldiers come up, more Roman soldiers, and more over here. Well, I had five guys. Wow. The trick was to learn, again, go back, the whole picture was storyboarded because we had no time for anything. We had no time to breathe, to get there. And by the time we got to the location, too, this was out in the desert in places, you know? And so I realized it was the old, you know, I drew the shots, and I figured, okay, I know what I have to do. But when I was doing it, I was just, oh, it was so painful. But I said, all right, this is it. Five of them come up here, flash pan, cut, same five guys. That's it. And then they had to fight the Levite guards. And they became the Levite guards on reverses. I'm not kidding. And I said, I can't believe what we're doing. I said, if I hadn't studied Roger Corman pictures, you would never be able to do this. But I mean, they were the same, the Levite guards. I couldn't believe it. I said, for the reverse, now we got, and they were all yelling in Italian and Spanish. It was the most despairing moment. And I had just read the reviews for Empire of the Sun and The Last Emperor. They sent Time Magazine. I said, oh, beautiful, we're gonna see the film. But look, they had, oh, look at all the extras he had. Oh, oh, what have I done? I said, maybe I was just too eager to do it. Maybe I should have waited. And Michael Ball, I said, Marty, they're never gonna give you that kind of extra for this picture. Let's shoot. Come on, get up, come on, let's go. And it was hysterical. If you look at the temple scene, every shot, the same guys. Every now and then we change a helmet. But the tricky one was the Levites. That was, oh man. So it's that kind of thing. And I was able then. I was able after that. I was right. What do we do after that, Thelma? Goodfellas. Oh, New York's well, Goodfellas, the major feature. Oh, Life Lessons. Yeah. And that was something that was Woody Allen's idea to do. He liked the old Italian films and French films of the early '60s. That they were a series of short stories, and that like Boccaccio 70 and pictures like that. And so he had originally talked to me, and then Francis did it, and that was something that had been worked on for a long time. That we had more leeway. We had $5 million to do that, and that was only a 40-minute film. See, and then Goodfellas, and Goodfellas was again one for me in a sense. And after that, we had to do the one for them in terms of for Cape Fear. And I don't say that in terms of excusing anything. That's a certain reality. And when I get myself involved in those situations, I try to learn as much as I can from the choice that I make. And I must tell you, Cape Fear was a very hard picture to make. And it was also the first film I used widescreen anamorphic lenses. And I learned how to work with boats. And of course, that's a very difficult thing to do. Storyboarded the entire picture, pretty much the entire, especially the boat sequence at the end. It's the first time I used a storyboard artist, but I worked with my own drawings first, and it took about 3 weeks for him to make the same kind of drawings, 200 shots. just for that sequence alone. So, you know, it became quite a job on that. And what are we doing now? Age of Innocence. Age of Innocence, I know you wanted to ask me about what Age of Innocence. Age of Innocence is something I've been wanting to do for Jay Cox. My old friend gave me the book 10 years ago, or more than that, 1980, 13 years ago. And I read it about 7 years ago. you know, and it takes me a long time to sort of gestate these things. What I'm trying these days to do is to do a lot of reading if I can. But I grew up on visual images, not books. And I saw movies and television shows and movies on TV, and there were no books in the house, really. It was the Daily News and the Daily Mirror. And I never read those, so. You know, and basically, I became exposed to visual literacy, I think. And these days, it's really fun to discover some authors and try to read the books and try to find the time to read the books, you know. In this case, Edith Wharton, The Age of Innocence. And so I wound up with, Jay gave me this book. He said, I know this is you, he said, when the time comes. And if you want to do a period piece. And so we wound up, finally, I think the film was commissioned by Fox, and then it went to Columbia Pictures when we were finishing Cape Fear. And it's kind of a departure, I think, and I've tried to utilize the same film language within a period setting, and as far as the themes are concerned and things like that, I mean, I can't really talk about that now, but the idea is a picture, it's really a picture that I wanted to make for many years, and we were lucky that Columbia Pictures gave us the money and the time to finish it properly.
Martin Scorsese recorded last June at New York University. The moderator was William Simon, chair of the Department of Cinema Studies at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.